Okay, so lesson two in this series, Grace in Romans, and this lesson, Renouncing of Grace, part one. And we're going to be covering here chapter one, verses one to chapter three, verse 25. So last week we started our series on this book, and I told you that we would be tracing the idea of grace as Paul explains it in this epistle. It's not a line-by-line study. We're focusing on a topic, one topic throughout the book, not line-by-line. That's why you need to read at home before we get here. So this is what the outline looks like. I explained that to you last week. That we're going to follow for this study. Five parts: renouncing of grace, response of grace, request of grace, refusal of grace, result of grace. Those are the five parts that cover the entire book. And this week we start with the first section where Paul explains how mankind, when I say man, I'm always referring to mankind, all right? So how mankind has renounced God's grace, and how this renunciation has led to what's called universal sin. And that's chapter 1 to chapter 3, verse 20. If you want to, someone say, what's Paul talking about at the beginning? He's talking about universal sin, and he explains it. So in the opening verses of the book, Paul greets his readers by establishing his credentials as an apostle. He summarizes what the gospel is, and he offers a blessing upon them. He also states his own objectives in ministry, and that is to preach to all men, meaning mankind, the gospel, to both Jews and to Gentiles, and that the gospel is God's power to save them. We talked about that passage in Romans 1, verse 16. He then begins his effort to show that all men need this gospel, and he does so by explaining, again, what we call the universality of sin. Now, before we examine Paul's teaching on the universality of sin, we need to look at an opposing view called, quite naturally, the universality of salvation, or by its more modern name, pluralism. You hear that sometimes, you know, in referring to religious ideas. Pluralism, you know, what's pluralism? Well, pluralism is the universality of salvation. It is a popular idea in the religious world that says that the love and the grace of God virtually ensures that everyone will be saved no matter what path they choose. That, in essence, is the idea of populism in religion. In diagram form, here's what this teaching looks like. There we go. All religions lead to God. All religions lead to God. Each religion is distinctive because of culture, geography, and history. However, all are capable of leading a person to God and thus salvation. You hear that all the time. People say, well, it doesn't matter if you're Hindu or Muslim. They all lead to God, just different ways to get to God. Well, that's universality of salvation, pluralism. Okay, and it's a very comforting thing. Well, why? You have no responsibilities. Everybody's going to heaven, so you know. Now, some Christian pluralists teach that every religion is really a form of underdeveloped Christianity, that when that particular religion matures, it will eventually lead them to Christ. You see what I'm saying? And so Islam is really just a immature form of Christianity. And if they finally, you know, work it all out, they'll eventually get on the Christianity track and get to heaven. One of the ideas that is out there. Now, we also have a universality, or the pluralism idea, within Christianity as a whole. Major Christian denominations have a smaller version of pluralism that says that all churches lead to heaven, but not all religions lead to heaven. You get what I'm saying? In other words, some pluralistic idea, but it's the same pluralistic idea, but it's restricted to Christianity only. So if you're wondering what this diagram is, it's a tree. You know, Christ is the trunk, and all the branches are all the different Christian, quote, religions that exist in the world. The Mennonites, the Anglicans, Orthodox, the Catholics, Jehovah's Witness, Mormon, whatever you got, it's just a branch of Christianity. All the branches are in the tree, and so therefore all the branches, you know, lead to heaven. Same thing. Universality of salvation, except within Christianity. The people that hold to this idea of universality use language like, you know, you're talking to one of these people when they use terms like, what's your religious expression? You know who you're talking to when they ask you that question. Or they say, this fellowship of believers over here, or that fellowship of believers over there. That's just another way of expressing this idea of universality of salvation, the doctrine of universality. These ideas, however, are easy to understand. They're also very attractive. You don't feel bad. You feel good about this. It's a feel-good thing. Why? Well, you don't condemn anybody. It's hard to condemn people. It's hard even thinking that people might be condemned. But, you know, with this idea, you don't have to worry about that. It's more loving. Oh, that's real love. The only problem is, there are two problems, actually. And the first problem is, it's illogical. It's not logical. It is illogical that God, who is perfectly logical, would give different and even contradicting information about himself and how to reach him to different people simultaneously. For example, Eastern religions like Hinduism and Jainism and Buddhism and all of those, they teach that man is responsible to reach a state of perfection. They call it different things, nirvana, moksha, you know, it's all different names, but it's the same thing. So man is responsible to reach a state of perfection and union with the force of life. And how do they do it? Either through a cycle of incarnation, you keep trying lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, you know, you get better every lifetime, and if you don't, you go lower, you know, you're a man, but then the next time you're a sheep, and then the next time you're a turtle, I don't know. It goes round and round. And union with the life force through either a cycle of incarnation, as I said, personal effort, and or acquiring special knowledge and insight through meditation and self-denial. I'm generalizing here, but these ideas are, you know, they're in every one of these religions. They just have a different different covering, different history, different geography. Western religions, like Judaism and Christianity and Islam, these are Western religions, they teach basically that God helps man to come to him, that he dies once, and then God judges each man. It's a similarity between Western religions. Eastern religions see God as a force without personality or will. Western religions see him as a sovereign, intelligent being. Eastern religions are inclusive, therefore all religious beliefs. In other words, all of them are okay. Western religions are exclusive. Only one religion is true. That's the difference between Eastern and Western religions. The point here is that the information about Hinduism will not lead a person to the same God and the same result as the information on Islam or even Christianity. A logical God does not purposefully give conflicting, illogical, and confusing information about himself. Universality would be true if in studying each religion, they basically gave kind of the same information, perhaps in different ways, you know, dressed up in different garb, but that's not the case. You follow the instructions of Hinduism, they will not lead you to the Christian God. You follow the instructions for Christianity, they will not lead you to the Hindu God. The second argument against universalism is it's unbiblical. That's from a Christian perspective. The Bible, and especially the book of Romans, has a very exclusive view of the Christian religion. It does assure all Christians that they are positively and completely saved forever and ever and ever, but the Bible also emphatically declares that those who are not Christians will perish. Not the most popular doctrine, not the easiest one to accept, even for Christians. Nevertheless, it's what the Bible does teach. It's for this reason the Christian religion was so despised in the beginning and continues to be despised today. When all the religions were inclusive, you could be a collector of gods and religions. The more you had, the better it is. But then the apostles showed up, and what did they say? And there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven that has been given among men by which we must be saved. The apostles came along and said there's only one God and there's only one way to God, and it's through Jesus Christ. Every other avenue is a dead end. Do you think people enjoyed hearing that? That didn't make them popular. They weren't martyred because Christianity was a new or different religion. They were despised because the disciples of Jesus dared to say it was the only religion. That's why they killed them. That's why they continue killing them today. If you're a Christian and you live in India, you're in danger. Because the Indian government is using the religion of Hinduism, which is the traditional religion of India, and they're using it much like the Roman Empire used emperor worship. The Roman Empire was spread all over the place, so they wanted to bring together, you know, the Roman Empire under one idea, and they came up with the idea of emperor worship. It wasn't about religion; it was about politics. They wanted everyone with the same mindset, so they enforced emperor worship. Well, in India, the largest population now in the world, they have so many people, so many different things, so many different subgroups, and so on and so forth. How do they bring all of these people together with one mindset? You know, India forever. You know, how do they do that? Well, through religion, through Hinduism. That's what they're doing. And so in a village, you know, Hindus go and they burn down the Christian church and they kill the Christians and they shoot them out of town. There's no pushback on that. Oh well, too bad, so sad. You know, the only ones who are outraged about that are American Christians. But there's nobody in the Indian government that's outraged about that. Why? Well, that's fine. That's good. That takes away any opposition to our religion. Anyways, I digress. So the first three chapters of Romans explains why and how this is so and sets the stage to explain why Christianity is the only religion that deals effectively with this. So in Romans 1 to 3, Paul, among other things, describes man's true condition. Remember we said the point is there are lots of religions in the world, and there are some that believe that all religions go to heaven. The apostles come up. That's not a new idea. That's a very old idea that continues on today. So now the apostles come along and they say, excuse me, but there is only one religion and only one way to go to heaven through Christ. Why? Because all men mankind are sinners, that's why. And God will condemn them, that's why. So this is the beginning of his argument, okay, in Romans 1 to 3. Man's true condition, he's fallen from the grace of God. He has renounced the grace of God. Man begins good, the recipient of God's grace as the head of creation, a partaker of the divine nature, an intimate relationship with God. All of this is possible. Why? Because of God's grace. This was God's first expression of grace towards mankind. And through disobedience, man fell or renounced this grace to the condition that Paul describes in 1, 2, and 3 in the book of Romans. In other words, what happens to you if you deny God's grace, if you renounce it? I don't want it. You push away from it. What happens to you? Paul explains here in 1, 2, and 3. And he begins describing this fall by describing the process in verses 18 to 23. The process of sin itself and how it leads to judgment and death. So let's read verse 18. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness." That's everybody's ungodliness. The Hindus over here who have an ancient religion, and the Egyptians over there, and the Indians in North America, and the Eskimos up in Alaska, all unrighteousness and ungodliness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So he describes the process of sin itself and how it leads to judgment. God punishes all who refuse and willingly suppress the truth. And what is the truth? Well, the truth is that there is a God. He can be known, and he is to be obeyed. That's the truth. That's the truth. And Paul says, it says that they who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. In other words, they must willingly suppress this truth that there is a God. They must willingly suppress the truth, or else it will just keep popping up. I use the example of a beach ball. You go into a swimming pool with a beach ball, right? What will it do? Well, it'll float on the water, right? So if you jump on it and you press it, you know, you get it to go underwater, what do you have to do to keep it underwater? Well, you have to suppress it. You have to push down on it. Because if you let go, what will happen? It'll just pop up again. That's the imagery. Paul says men are suppressing the truth, keeping it down, because without willful suppression of the truth will just pop up because it's so evident. In verses 19 and 20, he continues this thought. He says, "Because that which is known about God," the truth, "is evident within them, for God made it evident to them." In other words, God made mankind in such a way that he knows intuitively that there has to be a God. "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." So God, or truth, is known in two natural ways. On the inside of man, what would that be, on the inside of man? What would we call that? How would you know that? What's he talking about here? One word. Your conscience. We have a conscience. Okay? That's one way to know truth. And the other way to know it, he says here, through what has been made. So inwardly through our conscience, we recognize that there's a higher power. And outwardly, simply by observation, we see that there is a higher power. I mean, I can't produce grass. I can cut it. I can mow it. But I can't create it. So So there are two witnesses, as Paul says, that are so overpowering that nobody can plead ignorance. Then in verses 21 to 23, and I'll summarize this here in a minute. It says, for even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. So rather than responding to a fundamental truth that man has always known was there, historically, collectively, and individually, man has always known that there is a God, because God put the presence of himself within man, his conscience, and the creation itself. Now, knowing that there's a higher being, knowing that there's a God, doesn't tell you what he's like, or what he thinks, or what he wants. You know, all those details. But you can't deny that there's a God. Some greater power must have made all of this. Okay. The fact that only 30% of the population of the United States goes to church is a testimony to the idea that people continue to reject God's grace. And so, even though, he says, man has always known, he says, they have refused to acknowledge and honor God. They have refused to be grateful, even when he did acknowledge him. And they chose rather to worship baser things expressed in pagan religions, seeing in these a wisdom devised in their own minds. The pagan religions are always invented by human beings, not God. So instead of letting the truth emerge, Paul says man has chosen to pursue the courses above. Now in verses 24 and 25, he says, therefore, because this has happened, God gave them, who's the them? Well, the ones that suppress the truth, that refuse to recognize. God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever and ever. Amen. So the net result was that God did not intervene and permitted them to sin to their heart's content. You want to renounce me? You want to reject me? You don't want to accept all the witness that I'm giving you that I exist? You want to pursue your own religious ideas? You want to go your own way? God says, have at it. Go for it. I'm not going to stop you. Why? Exactly. I call it absolute free will. Drives some people crazy when I use that term. Absolute free will. Why do I call it absolute free will? Because God has given to mankind the absolute ability to reject him. Talk about the power of your own free will. You're allowed to say no to God. Now, there are consequences, of course, but you can still say no to God. No, I don't want you. No, I'm not obeying you. No, I'm not doing what you say. Or yes. And when you say no to God, he lets you go. So the net result is that God did not intervene and permitted them to sin to their heart's content. Paul, in the final verses, describes some of the sins that this fall from grace and process of sin led them to. And he's not describing, you know, a single person or a nation, but the natural progression of humanity that forsakes God. What is it? Refusal to acknowledge God as God. It starts there. Refusal to respond to God with thanksgiving. which I call the first sin. And then the creation of gods devised by human minds to fulfill the need of the human soul for the true God. The problem is, man has been designed in such a way that he will search for God. Otherwise, we wouldn't have paganism. We'd just have atheism. No God. You know, why? I don't need to worship. No, but why do we have so many pagan religions? Well, because mankind, he's wired to look for God because he can't deny that there is a God. And then the downward plunge into active evil. In a historical sense, the process is as follows. In a macrocosmic view of history, okay, so we're taking the big picture, okay? What does this fall from grace look like in a macrocosmic view? Well, it looks like this. The process of the fall from grace historically, it's cyclical. It's not linear. It's not this, and then the end. It's not that. It's cyclical. So you have God's grace is offered to you. We start there. Then the first step down is what's called a theological fall. What's a theological fall? Man refuses to recognize God as God. That's a theological fall. In other words, your theology is screwed up if you don't accept that. You may have theology, in other words, some idea about gods, and you're making up ideas about gods and worshiping gods, but you're not worshiping the true God. So you have a theological fall. When you have a theological fall, the next step on the downward slope is a philosophical fall. Because if your theology is wrong, then your thinking is wrong about other things. All kinds of philosophies begin to, you know, be developed and spouted. Because if you can't think right, if you cannot think right about God, then you can't think right about man and the world. So you have a philosophical fall. And once you have a philosophical fall, the next thing, you know, in the downward thing is a moral fall. You begin to do things that are not approved by God, that you have allowed yourself because of your fall. Now, as I say, this process is not linear, but rather cyclical. And throughout history, mankind has gone through this cycle over and over again. For example, just a few. Okay, you have the creation. You have from the creation to the Garden of Eden. What happens then? Well, you have your first fall with Adam. And it goes down. And what happens? Then Cain kills Abel. And then there's polygamy. And then there are wars, you know. And then Seth comes along and men begin to call on the name of the Lord. Oh, so a kind of revival comes. But then from Seth we go all the way to the flood, where the thought of every man was evil. The intention of every heart was evil. So, you know, it's gone down and down again. And what does God do? Well, he sends the flood. And then after the flood, Noah starts all over again to repopulate the earth and so on and so forth. And what happens? Well, we get to the Tower of Babel, where men now are starting to build a tower up to heaven. And so what does God do? He disperses them, takes away that power, and sends them to all points of the earth. And then you have Abraham is called, and a people are formed in order to put God's eventual plan of salvation into action. And that starts, you know, the people of God start. And throughout Jewish history, you see this circle going over and over again. This king was a good king. And, you know, we start with Saul. You know, it starts with great promise, but Saul goes crazy and, you know, tries to kill David, and he dies in shame and so on and so forth. And then, David comes, and then there's a glory, you know, and Solomon, a time of glory, you know, we're in the up circle, and then it starts to go down and down again because his descendants. And if you read the book of Kings and Numbers and all that, it says this king followed God. This king didn't follow God. This king was worse than the first king. You know, and you see the same cycle going round and round all the way to the time of the crucifixion. And then the Christianity comes in and there's not a revival, but there's light that comes into the world and the church starts to grow. And what happens? Well, we get to by the time of the Middle Ages, Christianity doesn't look anything like it is, like it was created. You have the Middle Ages. And then what do you have? The Reformation. The Bible is brought back, the word only. And so we have an awakening. We have a Reformed church. We have new zeal. The Bible, we're at the top of the cycle again. God's grace being distributed. And then what happens? We get to the Enlightenment. And now, the Enlightenment is the demonstration of a philosophical fall. The Enlightenment, man is enlightened, and we get all kinds of new philosophies coming, pragmatism and, all the different philosophies. You have all the different philosophers that try to explain the existence of the world with no reference to God. And what does that do? Well, we go into a moral fall. Then we have the Restoration, the Great Awakening, mostly in the West, where that brings us to the present. Again, I've really shortened this thing here. And now, the cycle continues. It's going down. And where are we? Well, just take a look. Men are women. Women are men. And people actually debate this idea. They debate it. Can a man have a baby? can a man have a baby? If you would have said that 100 years ago as a debate question, you'd have been thrown out. They wouldn't even talk to you. But now it's a legitimate question for debate. Do you see the philosophical fall there? So we see the cycle in modern history. In the 20th and 21st centuries, the theological fall came with the rejection of the Bible and the inspiration in most mainline denominations the last 50 years, spearheaded with scholars of what's called the high critical method. In other words, they saw the Bible only as a piece of literature and not as an inspired document. These teachers, this higher criticism in many of the universities in the world, these influence the writers and the ministers and the leaders of mainline denominational churches to begin to reject the Bible's authority and rely more on social and psychological sources for ministry and models, church models, moral issues. The Lutheran Church ordains active homosexuals because it no longer considers the Bible as authority. They say, how can they do that? Well, because the Bible is no longer the inspired authority. Well, if the Bible is no longer the inspired authority, you get to do what you want to do. And then there's the philosophical fall occurred simultaneously with the great thinkers establishing the idea of relativism as a new basis for thinking about ourselves and our world. Relativism has many variations, but basically it says that the only rules that one is bound by are those one creates for himself. We see in this thinking expressed in pro-choice movement, for example. The pro-choice movement would never happen had not the philosophers come up with the idea of relativism. No one can impose a standard on the individual that he or she has not chosen for himself or herself. And so the ability to choose trumps God's command that thou shalt not kill. Social laws are valid because they have been chosen by the majority. They have no value in themselves. We believe that basic laws should be there because they are naturally good. So government and politics and law is very important in a relativistic world because these are the only vehicles to establish what a society is to be. We don't look at the Bible anymore to guide what a society should be. Now the politicians and the lawyers and the judges, they decide what society should be. So if 9 judges decide that 2 men can marry each other and that's a legal thing and society ought to accept it, that's it. That's it. If 9 judges decide babies can be killed within the womb, that's it. If they then decide you can kill them once they're outside the womb, if you decide you have the baby and you say, you know, I don't think I really want this baby, you can put it to death. If 9 judges decide that that's okay, then it's okay. Doesn't matter if the Bible says, thou shalt not kill. That doesn't matter anymore because we don't use the Bible anymore. We use human beings to figure out what our laws are going to be. That's what a philosophical fall is. That's my point. It leads to a moral fall. Why? Because man, you know, does not know how to lead the way. So we should be afraid of a completely relativistic country like Russia, for example, becoming a complete democracy without any religious conscience because fueled by our capitalistic system and a nation that is totally relativistic, they could choose to collectively destroy us and have the money to do it and feel no remorse because, well, it was the will of the majority. It isn't that might makes right, what Nietzsche kind of said. It's that the majority has priority. The problem in our country today is that we're kind of split down the middle, aren't we? That's why there's so much, you know, no one idea prevails. In a relativistic world, there's no such thing as loving your enemy, because a majority of the people would never choose to adopt such a policy. Only a religious people would do so. After World War II, what do you think was motivating the idea that America would go and help Japan rebuild and have the Marshall Plan and have, you know, our money and our technology and our people go to Europe to help to build rebuild Germany? In a relativistic world, man, that wouldn't wash at all. And then, of course, the moral fall that follows. We are currently experiencing the moral fall of the West. The East fell with communism and secularism in Europe. They're done. When homosexuals march in the street for their rights, when governments openly rob their own people, when God's name is publicly blasphemed before millions of people in the media day after day after day, and there's no outrage and there's no way to stop it, when we glorify and we pour adulation on liars and thieves and fornicators and God-haters as we do on many of our entertainers and athletes who publicly act this way without shame, I mean, trans influencers online with millions of followers? What's that? When this type of systemic immorality becomes clear and visible to everyone, then 3 possible things are near. You know, what a crazy world we live in. The world gives one day of honor to Jesus Christ. And I say honor, you know. Christmas, one day of honor to Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world. One day. But homosexuals get a whole month? Are we nuts or what? What's wrong with us? So, when this type of systemic immorality becomes clear and visible to everyone, then 3 possible things are near. First, the end of the moral fall. We're nearing the end or the bottom of the moral fall. You can't go much lower when child molesters claim that they were born that way and they shouldn't be penalized for their behavior, which is what's happening. And people say, that'll never happen. Well, I'm old enough to remember when the idea of a gay marriage was brought up, and people were saying, that'll never happen. I mean, people know that two men can't get married. That'll never happen. Well, guess what? And this is my own little prediction here for what it's worth, but the day that they legalize and accept pedophilia in this nation, then you can believe that we're done. But just from a big picture stance here, we are, in that cycle, theological fall, philosophical fall, moral fall. We're in there. We're in the moral fall part, okay? So one thing can happen. It'll be the end. Second thing that can happen, we're near the beginning of another period of God's grace as the cycle begins a new phase of history. This is seen in the working of the Holy Spirit, strengthening the church to grow dynamically. Spiritual and moral fervor is felt for Christ. Not just any revival of religion, not for any one particular church, but the rise once again of the church that belongs to Christ. Because let's face it, we're near the end of the world. That's a third thing. We're near the end of the world brought on by the return of Jesus. So my point is, when we get to the bottom, we only have two ways to go. We get back to the top. Another period of grace. God intervenes and strengthens the church, and there's a great awakening, and the church begins to grow, and people come to Christ, and a renewal that comes, which is then followed by another fall, and the cycle keeps going round and round throughout history. So we're either going to have a period of grace. I hope we do that. I hope we do that. Or the only other conclusion, or Jesus will come. Because it is when there is the greatest challenge to God's authority and position that Jesus returns. This is what 2 Thessalonians teaches. However, I say, the man of lawlessness has not yet been revealed. So I doubt we're at this point. So don't misunderstand me. I'm not preaching the Lord is coming, this year. I'm not saying that. I'm saying when the way this cycle works throughout history, we're at the point now, either we're going to have a period of renewal or the Lord will come. The man of lawlessness will be revealed in some way and the Lord will come. Either way, we're ahead. This is how the cycle continues to play out throughout history. So I come back to Romans. In chapter 1 of Romans, Paul is describing this cycle of falling from grace and how all humans are caught up in it in one way or another. In chapters 2 and 3, he goes from a macrocosmic big picture view, which I just explained to you, to a microcosmic detailed view of the same thing, but in a single person. So the big picture view, Romans 1. The small picture view, Romans 2 and 3. From the moral history of mankind to the workings of sin in the heart of each individual man, and the result of this in the lives of individual Jews and Gentiles. So the lesson for us so far is that this cycle continues and each of us is caught up in it, despite our advanced technology and global worldview. And the moral collapse of society is played out in each of our personal lives as well. So in the end, there remains only one name under heaven, by which we must be saved also, and that's Jesus Christ. It's as true today as it was when Paul wrote the book of Romans. I told you, the power of the gospel, which is the revealed grace of God, is just as powerful today as it was then. When we study Romans, or any other book of the Bible for that matter, we are handling that power, that spirit, that life that can lead us to a state of grace, or it can ignite a period of grace for the whole world if we're not part of it. Such is, just last thing, such is the power of the gospel that Paul speaks of. It can ignite a new period of grace, a new period of renewal, not just in one person's life, but in the whole world. Okay? All right, so we had to kind of understand the big picture before we understand the small picture, which we will get into next week. That's it for now. Thank you very much for your attention. We are dismissed.